Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we proceed any further, I want to thank all those who pledged in support of Talking Animals last Wednesday morning or prior. And I'm pleased to report that in the final minute of the show, we reached our fundraising goal. So I feel very fortunate. Thank you again. Now, unfortunately, the station fell short of its overall goal for the fund drive. So if you didn't have an opportunity to donate last week, or even if you did and would like to pledge again, please visit WMNF.org and contribute there. Thank you. My guest today is William Finnegan, a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1987, winner of numerous top journalism awards and the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Barbarian Days. Finnegan has written a broad, deep, extended exploration of horse racing in the current issue of the magazine. The piece is available online where the title is Can Horse Racing Survive? While the headline of the print version is Blood on the Tracks. The story examines some of the biggest challenges facing horse racing, like the death in 2019 of more than 35 horses in Santa Anita Park, the ongoing specter of doping, the greatly diminished number of patrons and betting at most tracks, and what the future may hold for the sport. Along the way, Finnegan addresses some of horse racing's colorful characters and key figures, like Bob Baffert, the white-haired trainer whose horses have not infrequently tested positive for banned drugs, most recently Kentucky Derby winner Medina Spirit. We'll delve into the complex world of horse racing by way of a sweeping, deeply reported New Yorker piece when I speak with William Finnegan in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, later in today's program, the Comedy Corner piece will be a perfect complement to this discussion about horse racing, so stay tuned for that as well. Also later in this morning, I'll speak with Amber Lee, a managing partner of Ybor City Vegan Deli, part of a growing string of vegan delis that began in Dunedin, added Brandon, then Ybor, with a Sarasota location expected next. Clearly, there's a vegan deli craze underway in this part of Florida, and we'll talk a bit about with Amber Lee later in today's show. Right now, though, let's talk horse racing with William Finnegan, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is William Finnegan on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, William.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And at this stage of the game, given your long tenure at The New Yorker, I imagine you select or at least pitch your stories. I mean, it's probably been a few decades since someone said, hey, why don't you go cover the Planning Commission meeting on Tuesday night? So I guess the question to start off with is, why a story on horse racing?
Well, unfortunately, you have it backward. They still tell me to go do things.
Oh, really? Wow.
Not in any imperious way, but in this case, I'm from Southern California. That might have been part of it. Written a bit about sports. That might have been part. It's just it was kind of a complicated subject to take on, investigative and sort of broad, and so they just thought of me, and I said okay.
Well, I already learned something. I would have thought for sure that would have been something you would have generated and had some kind of particular interest in, and said okay, this is going to be big and broad and investigative, but I'd like to do it. So sounds like that kind of happened, but only by their initial sort of suggestion.
That's true.
So I'm sure we can't really discuss horse racing or your piece without almost immediately diving into Santa Anita Park. I mean, in recent years, it's hard to imagine there's been a track that's more famous or infamous. And it kind of seems like Santa Anita in many ways serves as kind of an anchor for your piece for reasons that are both obvious and not so obvious. Of course, the most notable element I mentioned at the beginning of the show is the huge string of horse deaths there in 2019, I guess 37, if I have the count right, horses died that year, which focused the kind of attention on the perils of horse racing, and your lead kind of plunges us right into that with a pretty devastating climax. So there was an odd confluence of factors, it seemed like, very much including meteorological, that made the track so hazardous for that period where all those horses did die. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is the beginning of 2019, the winter meet, there was a mega drought in California, years and years of very dry, almost no rain years, and then just a deluge. I think it was 18 inches in a couple of months, which is really a lot for Southern California. And so the track was a bit of a mess. That is to say, to deal with all that water, they started sealing the track, which is a common thing to do when you've got just too much water. They run heavy presses over it at night usually and press the water out of it and make it such that it won't absorb more water. And that can work, you know, after the rain passes, you harrow the track and it gets to be a reasonable running track and you can go. But when you have to do that night after night after night or day after day, you develop a track that's really hard, really unforgiving. And that's one of the things that happened in Santa Anita. And why they kept running is another question. By the way, a really sloppy track, which is sort of dramatic to watch, and you think, oh, how can these horses run in all that mud? That's not necessarily dangerous. It's that sealed track that was the real problem at Santa Anita.
Yeah, it sounds like the muddy, sloppy track is, as much as it might look nerve-wracking to those of us who don't know enough about it, maybe, it sounds like it's much safer than the dry, packed track.
Yeah, and some horses, you know, specialize in that, and they're known as mudders, and you know, handicappers bet on them when it rains.
So, really, this process, because the incredible drought leading then followed by the incredible rainfall led to all this packing, and that's really what we can point to for that horrific string of horse deaths.
Well, it's one of the things. I mean, that kind of sealed track, you know, multiply sealed, really hard and very hard on horses' legs, especially the lower legs, and you end up with these micro fractures, which can become stress fractures, which can then, you know, sort of explode into major injuries and what they call catastrophic breakdowns. And that started happening at a pretty incredible rate, 23 horses over the first 2.5 months. It's not to say that, I mean, Dot on the track of Santa Anita, that's both training and racing, which is not to say that horses in thoroughbred racing don't die at a pretty regular rate already. They do.
Yeah.
But this was way over that rate. And the reason it got so, I mean, it rose to the level that mainstream media began to pay attention to the fact that this was happening. And I think the general public doesn't realize how many horses die in horse racing. And suddenly that was, you know, on the pages of their papers and in their internet feeds. And it was shocking. And the sort of public alarm grew from there.
And then what really happened? Because it was shocking, and then there were, as you suggest, reporting peripherally or otherwise about how it's an extreme case, but it's not uncommon, and deaths at other tracks. And then I guess one of my questions in thinking about your piece was, did the pandemic kind of remove horse racing injuries and deaths from the spotlight enough where all that focus that had been thrown on it because of the Santa Anita situation sort of didn't go away entirely, but it certainly greatly diminished?
Yeah, that did happen. I mean, this was early 2019 when the Santa Anita crisis was sort of spinning.
Yeah.
And of course, the pandemic didn't happen until 2020. But in terms of general public opinion, yeah, things were getting sort of worse and worse for horse racing. And they reached a kind of nadir in early March 2020, just before the pandemic landed on us, when there was a big FBI bust in primarily in New Jersey. 27 people indicted for horse doping, including a couple of very prominent trainers. And that was when it really seemed like horse racing was on its heels, so to speak. I mean, people were really panicking. There was an editorial in the Washington Post saying, you know, this is it. You know, it's time to ban this so-called sport. And it was seemingly a sort of complete crisis point. And then a few days later, you know, COVID-19 hit us hard and horse racing vanished from the headlines. And you hardly heard anything about it for a year.
Yeah, it does seem like there's cases like this, like that big bust, and there's people that also seem like sort of untouchable or just seems like things roll off their back, and maybe we'll talk about, I have someone in mind in particular that I'm talking about. But yeah, so it just seems like just when you think, okay, and the Washington Post has this editorial and big, big news about the bust. And then, again, we all, I guess, could be forgiven for being distracted because we're all distracted about a number of things. But I guess part of the premise of your piece is, like, can horse racing survive? And it almost feels like those people who feel like, hey, this time has come, and even the people that behind the Washington Post editorial or any number of other people have similar viewpoints, they're not really starting over, but it feels like they've taken some big steps back to then sort of even get near where they were before.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, horse racing's been in decline for a long time. You know, it used to be the most popular spectator sport in America, and many, many tracks have closed. The thoroughbred foal crop is half the size it was 30 years ago. The betting handle is half what it was 30 years ago. And so that's happening, you know, sort of socially and historically already.
Yeah.
And then I was concentrating in California partly because this Santa Anita story became so big. And it was interesting, you know, why were they still running on a sealed track? You know, who's making these decisions? And I delve into that.
Yeah.
Also, California is, you know, California. It's a place where, you know, alligator shoes are banned. I mean, it's also politically often driven by these statewide referenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they recall governors and some real history-changing issues have appeared on the ballot there and, you know, sort of changed the whole property tax structure, for instance. And so activists, you know, anti-racing activists have been talking about getting the question of banning horse racing on the ballot there in California, a statewide referendum. And, you know, it's a very good chance that people would give it a big thumbs down. I mean, it's a lot of animal lovers in California, not a lot of horse racing fans, at least compared to the past.
Yeah,
that hasn't happened, and I'm not sure how easily it could happen. It turns out to take a lot of money and a lot of signatures to get an issue on the state ballot, but that seemed to be the sort of leading edge of the sort of abolitionist movement. So that's why I went there.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about those factions that do oppose horse racing, because you mentioned the abolitionists, and in your piece you also say there's the welfarists that are looking for incremental change. And at one point, I think in there, when PETA is considered sort of a milquetoast advocate on any kind of issue, we've definitely stepped into a strange new world.
Yeah, it's, people in racing, you know, complain about PETA trying to ban racing or demonizing people in racing. But the truth is, yeah, that PETA, you know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, which has done all this, you know, big work in banning testing on animals and, industry and the military, and is generally considered a kind of leading-edge animal rights organization. PETA's actually been working with the tracks, including the owners of Santa Anita, to get sort of incremental reforms, as you say, like reduce the use of the whip, or what's mm-hmm. called crop, or eliminate the use of the crop, and that kind of thing, as opposed to more militant organizations. A leading one is called Horse Racing Wrong, that simply want to, you know, banish horse racing entirely.
Yeah, and that's interesting. A few reasons about PETA, just because whatever your view of PETA is, and they're certainly a polarizing force no matter where you are, but still they're pretty smart. So to me, it suggests that they really looked at the situation and said incremental is the way we're going to make headway here. If we really go for the all-out ban, realistically, yeah, there probably isn't going to be the money, the resources, the support for this. So let's just make some progress.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for PETA, but it may well be that their ultimate goal is also to, you know, ban horse racing. I mean, people often lump it together with elephants in the circus and, you know, dog racing, which has been largely banned, and
yeah,
you know, dolphin shows, all these kind of discredited animal entertainments.
Yeah,
we'll be next.
Right, and when you talk about dog racing, of course, I'm talking to you from a state where that did finally voted out. And but I remember when I was doing a story about it when it was still active, and I went to one of the tracks, and it reminded me of kind of a lot of what you describe in your piece. I mean, in a way, within your article, you've kind of almost written a something of a profile of Santa Anita, like a place that's functioning, obviously, but clearly a place whose best and busiest days are behind it. And you talk about only a few betting windows are open most days, and kind of this unusual visual about this huge sweeping bathroom with these row of urinals and no one's there. And and just that it just seems kind of quiet, and you almost could see a tumbleweed rolling through. And that was my recollection, too. Even a good year or so before, dog racing ban was even proposed, much less enacted. And so it just feels like, and I guess another part of that portrayal was noting that the crowd at Santa Anita is predominantly working class, which I thought was also interesting because, you know, a lot of people think, especially this time of year, of horse racing, and it's the kooky hat and the mint juleps and the triple crown and people dressed up. But that's really an anomaly in terms of horse racing world.
Well, yes and no. That is, daily, you know, ordinary day at the races is, as you mentioned and as I described, Santa Anita. It's not a gala. It's not well attended. It's not a society event. There's not a lot of money at the track, so to speak.
Yeah.
But in general, it's still there's a kind of upper class, a money class investment in horse racing, especially in the breeding industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of centered in Kentucky, Kentucky bluegrass country, also in South Florida, also in New York around Saratoga and Belmont here near New York City. But lots of international money, lots of money from the Middle East. It's a $100 billion industry still globally. It's quite healthy in Europe and Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, Australia, South America. I mean, it's still going.
Yeah.
But some of the sort of popular breadth of it has certainly shrunk. And I'd say a real concern for people in horse racing who hope for it to continue is that there aren't many young fans. I don't see young people turning up at the races, and maybe a few. There's a sort of infamous new type of owner, a hedge funder who buys just part of a horse through a syndicate and doesn't necessarily know a lot about racing. But that again is those are very few people, so they've got a kind of generational problem that could lead toward its extinction, I think.
Yeah, because there's just not really a new population replacing the kind of currently fading large contingent of horse racing fans. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is William Finnegan, a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1987, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of an extended exploration of horse racing in the current issue of the magazine. If you'd like to ask William a question about his piece or more broadly about horse racing or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So you clearly did an enormous amount of reporting and research en route to writing this story. Given what you learned, if you were sitting in my seat, what are one or the two elements, issues, or people you think we should absolutely discuss that we haven't touched on so far?
Well, there's a kind of, the sort of industry ownership level. The biggest owner of racetracks in North America is a Canadian conglomerate called the Stronach Group. They're privately held. It's hard to get a lot of information about how they operate, but they own Santa Anita, for instance, and they can determine a lot about what happens with horse racing. Belinda Stronach, the leader of the company, is identified now with reforms, medication reforms, an effort to reduce the doping problem, which is historic. I mean, it's been around for, since racing started. It was bad in the 19th century, in the
yeah. years,
let alone the 21st. And yet, she and that company are also responsible in many ways for what happened at Santa Anita. I mean, the decisions to keep running, even when the track was not safe. The Stronach also owns Gulfstream there in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the sort of PR effort, we're for safer, more modern racing. And then there's the sort of profit motive and a somewhat shadowy corporate structure to me. That is, some of the biggest bettors in racing, really kind of keep the money turning, are what are called high-volume betting shops, which, again, are kind of hard to get into the details of because
yeah.
they don't divulge those things. But Stronach owns one of the leading clubs of high volume bettors who rely heavily on computers to kind of cover all the inefficiencies in the big payouts and make these, you know, I would say intelligent bets, but sort of artificially intelligent bets that actually make money betting, which is certainly the exception. And this one group called the Elite Turf Club in Curaçao, based in, you know, the Caribbean, with 11 members supposedly, or 12 members, and Stronach owns that, as well as the tracks, as well as, you know, big wagering platforms. And so there's that level of racing that's a little mysterious and I worked on, but can't say I ever really came to understand.
Yeah, well, I guess it's if you're Stronach, it's good to be on all sides of the equation.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what sort of influence do they wield? I mean, it seems like, as you kind of alluded to, they're associated with things that suggest reforms in horse racing. But sometimes I look at things or try to read things and I can't help but thinking, are they blocking reformation efforts?
Well, at this point, there's a big reform effort that was in the last omnibus spending bill in Congress at the end of last year,
mm-hmm.
Kind of tucked in there, and it passed. It's called the Horse Racing Safety and Integrity Act. I'd have that backward, integrity and safety. Anyway, it's a major reform. It's going to put anti-doping regulation all under one national body, which is being developed now, and it'll be under what's called the United States Anti-Doping Association, which is you know, quite reputable part of the World Anti-Doping Association, and that will be a big difference, because up till now, horse racing has been regulated by a series of state racing commissions, like 38 different ones in states that have horse racing, and they all have different standards and different kinds of labs, and they're quite, and you can get in trouble in one and move to the next jurisdiction, and it's just been a really antique, not functional system. So some of the big players, including Stronach in racing, pushed for this legislation. It actually got through, and we'll have a reform at that level. And that's just to, you know, kind of standardize and modernize out of competition testing of horses, and it's been kind of slaps on the wrist for most offenders in this area for many, many years. You know, depending on who they know, there's a lot of kind of old boys networks in racing. And in fact, when this is to somewhat change the subject, but as legalized gambling kind of swept the country, you know, used to be only in Las Vegas at the track, and then the first casino opened in Atlantic City in 1978, and then there's just, you know, there's been 1,000 casinos open since, many of them on Native American reservations, and state lotteries, all these things have really cut into horse racing's former monopoly on legalized gambling, and state racing commissions, often friendly with state legislatures, were able to go to them and say, look, this is happening to us, you know, we're going to need subsidies, and they got those subsidies. So that's what I mean about the old boys networks, and some of those subsidies are now being questioned. Do we really need to give, you know, $1 billion to the horse breeding industry, or would it be better spent on schools, those kinds of issues? So they're at that level, there's sort of a lot moving, a lot of tectonic plates moving that will affect horse racing for sure.
Now, a couple of things you said in that last thing about old boy networks and the things, slaps on the hands. I'm saying this kind of tongue-in-cheek at first, but I'm working on developing a remake of an old Bill Murray film, What About Bob? But in this movie, instead of being severely dependent on his shrink, the lead character is a horse trainer who seems dependent on banned performance-enhancing substances. It's called What About Bob Baffert? So, but seriously, but what about Bob Baffert? I mean, he seems invincible. His horses, you know better than anyone, have won a number of races clouded by suspicion, if not actually testing positive for banned substances, as recently as the Kentucky Derby winner, Medina Spirit, and then cleared to run the next race.
Yeah, well, there have been 30 cases of Baffert horses, you know, testing dirty. That's a lot. He's been in it a long time. He's always got an excuse, you know, the dog ate his homework this way or that way.
Yeah.
And some of them seem absurd. Others are, you know, sort of upheld or defended. The most egregious really was a couple of years ago. He had a horse, Justify, that won the Triple Crown. and then turned out to have a failed drug test in California from before the Triple Crown, and it had been, you know, they were mulling it over at the California Horse Racing Board secretly all this time, and they finally announced their finding. Oh, there was this problem, but now we think it was contaminated feed, and that was really one of the more egregious instances. But I would say that none of these. Well, earlier in Baffert's career, there was a thyroid drug that a lot of people were giving their horses. And I should say that the whole medication prescription system in horse racing is really messed up. I mean, the prescription should come with a diagnosis, right? A vet should say, oh, you've got this problem and I prescribe this drug, but it doesn't really work that way. Trainers often tell vets, I want this, give them this, and they either do or they get another vet. So that is an area that really needs reform. This thyroid drug, I think, was responsible for the death of a number of horses, and people who were using it, kind of realized it, including Baffert, and stopped using it. But most of these recent failed drug tests are relatively minor stuff. I mean, the Medina Spirit case, for instance, which is huge, it's the Kentucky Derby, and when the split sample comes back to do the second test, may take the Derby win away from Medina Spirit and may get Baffert in more serious trouble. Was a relatively minor drug in a tiny amount, and they've got an excuse for it, of course, but he's definitely been riding right along the edge for many years, and there are also, of course, drugs that can't be detected. There's always a sort of development in this field, and often, using adapted medications for humans or horses, and the testing can't keep up with it. I mean, hopefully with this big reform and this new national regulatory body, we'll have more competent, more comprehensive testing. But it's hard to really know what's been going on because the testing is so antiquated.
Yeah. And I'm going to get a caller involved here and get some emails too for you, William. But that last thing you just said about Medina Spirit, I wondered this when it was found that there was a drug issue with Medina Spirit. And this came up the other night too with some friends at dinner. So in that case, Medina Spirit wins the Kentucky Derby. Then there's a drug issue that's unresolved, I guess, until the final results of the follow-up test come in. But if I'm at the track that day, and I bet on Medina Spirit, and I went back to that window and collected my winnings, what happens later if Medina Spirit is indeed disqualified and not the winner of the Kentucky Derby ultimately? What happens to those monies, and how does that get handled?
As I understand it, basically nothing happens.
Okay.
You keep your winnings. They're not going to try to claw them back from you.
Yeah, it'd be pretty hard to do.
On the second horse, in this case, Mandaloon, if you bet on that horse to win, and you obviously didn't win, they're not going to come look you up and make you whole. It's the
okay.
I think it's day of the qualifications that happen for jostling
at that moment.
On the day, and then they can adjust the payouts. I mean, they'll hold them back if there's a question. But after the day passes, that's it. You win or you lose according to those not the historic. What's going into the history books, but according to what happened that day and what they understood that day.
Okay, so you leave the track that day, and whatever else happens, that's kind of good news or bad news, but it doesn't affect your winnings or lack of winnings.
And you're going to have a lot of very unhappy bettors.
I'm sure.
And some happy ones.
I'm sure, but there's a lot at stake. All right, well, let's get one of our callers involved here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with William Finnegan.
Hi, William.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm on your show.
I'm sorry, you're on the air. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I have two questions for your guest.
Okay.
One is, I think it was Guacamo that they put sponges in his nose and he couldn't breathe, and then he died during a horse race, or he tripped and then he died because he broke his leg. And then the second thing is, my Uncle Sal had horses in St. Louis, and I used to clean the stables at Fairmont, and there were always notes on the wall inside the stables about syringes being left on the floor and in the stable floor. I was wondering, are any of those the drugs that they use on horses, are any of those harmful to humans? Like if somebody were to pick up one of those syringes and inject themselves with one of the steroids, is it harmful to humans? Those are my two questions.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Well, the first question, I don't know that horse in that story, but the practice of, you know, sticking something up the nose of a horse, that is a horse you're competing with and you don't want it to run well, that's infamous. I don't know if it's happening just lately, but it has certainly happened over time. And I don't know about horses that have died on the track as a result, but certainly horses have lost because somebody stuck something up their nose. People find every imaginable way to cheat in racing, and I think always have. As for the syringes, I mean, there are a lot of syringes around even today, legally. And that's how horses get most of the medications they take. They don't, you know, ask them to swallow a pill. And as for the how dangerous those, it depends. I mean, some of these are very small doses of corticosteroids. For instance, that's the kind of thing that Medina Spirit had in his system when they tested him after the Derby. And I mean, in the past, in the sort of pre-testing past, people used everything you could think of. I mean, heroin, morphine, strychnine, caffeine, injecting horses with, you know, making them drink whiskey, you name it, whatever they thought might make a horse run faster, or in the case of trying to slow down the competitor, make the horse run more slowly. And some of those obviously are more dangerous to people than others. But I don't think the syringes laying around, I mean, there shouldn't be any syringes laying around, but I don't think any of that is sort of deadly to humans. No, the idea is just, to be safe with that stuff. And I need to emphasize that a lot of that stuff is legit. You know, the horse has a inflammation and can take an anti-inflammatory. It's not near race time. It's just part of his, they train hard, they race hard, they're athletes, they're sore, they're got a lot of small injuries.
Okay, well, thanks, caller, and thanks, William, for that answer. And that reminds me of something I definitely wanted to ask about, but let me just read one of these emails, at least in the meantime. I believe that the fan base for this cruel sport is shrinking because of great reporting, investigations, and efforts to educate the public. It's got to end. Thanks, William Finnegan. Thanks, Talking Animals. But that last discussion with the caller and then your response to it reminds me, I wanted to talk at least a little bit about Lasix. Maybe you could just briefly say what it is, and then I got a question or two kind of about it.
Yeah, it's a Lasix is a diuretic. People sometimes take it won't kill you, but it's defended as a necessary sort of safety measure, a precaution against pulmonary bleeding. Bleeding in the lungs, which is a problem with a lot of horses. I mean, they run really hard and it causes some bleeding in the lungs. I would say, and I think most experts would say, although not all horsemen agree with this at all, that it's very few horses who are bleeders to the point that it's dangerous. It can be ugly. I mean, they can cough up blood and the jockey and the horse can end up covered with blood. That's a serious case and obviously not a good look these days.
Yeah.
But Lasix is meant to prevent that, and it's extremely popular in the U.S., and we're talking about race day Lasix, you know, getting a shot that morning. And people who would say that it's a performance-enhancing medication, and I might agree with this, would point to the fact that it being a diuretic, it causes the horses to urinate tremendous amounts, like 20, 30 pounds, people say, which, you know, lightens the horse and obviously gives you a chance to run faster. And so the push in American racing, and I should say race day Lasix is banned everywhere else, banned in Europe, Japan, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, the Australia, just it's considered, cheating to give a horse Lasix on race day and unnecessary. But it's been legal here for many years, and you even see it in the racing program. There's a big L next to the horse, you know,
yeah,
on Lasix. And if it's a horse running for the first time on Lasix, for instance, a horse that's shipped in from overseas, from Europe, say, you'll say L1, which will tell a better, okay, this horse is going to run lighter than he ever ran before. Maybe he'll run faster. She'll run faster. So it's a real, issue in racing, and they are starting to phase it out. And Stronach's been in the vanguard of saying, you know, we've got to get rid of Lasix, race day Lasix. And so far, the results have not been the least bit catastrophic. You don't have sort of blood all over the tracks in these races that are being run for the first time without race day Lasix, first time in the U.S. in quite a while. But you do notice that when for the big, like Breeders' Cup, these big races that draw a lot of horses from overseas, virtually every horse shows up, and whether they've ever used Lasix or not, they use it on race day. I mean, it's people consider it an advantage. So
yeah,
it's I think it'll be phased out.
Okay, that's interesting because in the kind of setting the scene of the first part of your piece, you talk about at least in the one race in particular, every horse had the indication that they had taken Lasix, and
so it's been true for a long time in American racing, and
yeah,
some of those horses were from overseas, but pretty much everybody takes it, and do they need it? A lot of horsemen and track veterinarians told me yes, it's good for the horse. It lowers blood pressure. It is the humane thing to do. You know, look down their throats after a race. You want to limit bleeding, and that's a passionate and solid argument. But whether it's really necessary, race day Lasix for thoroughbred racing is debatable, and I'd have to say I don't agree that it is.
Well, also, it's hard not to notice that, as you've pointed out, that globally it's banned in so many countries. There must be, something to that. I mean, so.
Well, the question, though, is if that's medical or it's just like perception. You know, the public sees that as cheating, and therefore we shouldn't do it, even though vets say, it's in the interest of horse welfare, you should do it. So it's sort of an endless debate that's really still open.
Yeah. So one of our emailers says, kind of touched on this a little bit, I think, earlier, but says, does your guest think that horse racing will eventually be banned, much like dog racing is in many states? I've not heard of any efforts to stop horse racing in Florida.
I don't think it'll go soon or go as easily as dog racing did or is. And Florida, it's sort of state to state. I mean, Florida is the horse racing industry and breeding industry are pretty strong. Kentucky's kind of the industry headquarters, really strong there. New York, California is a special case, kind of low horse population, but still some big successful tracks. And I could see the industry contracting and more regional tracks. I mean, there are no tracks left in New England. There used to be, dozens of racetracks throughout New England, and they're all closed. And so I see it contracting. I just don't know about the kind of what I picture as the final redoubts of thoroughbred racing, like Florida and Kentucky and so on. I don't see how that will go because they've got a lot of, support, political support, a lot of, juice, a lot of very wealthy people deeply involved, and a certain amount of, popular support. So it's hard to, over the long haul, perhaps yes, but in the short term, I can't really see it, no.
Yeah, and even if it were to go in a certain state, it's hard to imagine that it would be, more broad than that, at least for a while, just given...
No, I can't picture a national ban. It would be sort of state by state, and it hasn't been banned in any state that I know of. It's just kind of fallen away in some states and continues to fall away in others. And as I say, these state subsidies that came in the wake of legalized gambling, casinos, state lotteries, are pretty crucial to survival in some states. In Pennsylvania, for instance, the governor has been saying, enough with this. Let's spend that money on education. And people in horse racing there are understandably kind of panicking.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, William. But one thing I wanted to ask about when we were talking about kind of the race that you set the scene with at the beginning of your piece, which again, by the way, for people who might have just joined us, we've been speaking with William Finnegan, staff writer at The New Yorker, and his new piece on horse racing is available online currently, and it's in the May 24th edition of the print of the magazine itself. Unfortunately, the part of setting the scene and what we see happening relative to Santa Anita is this pretty devastating climax with Mongolian Groom. But along the way, as you're sort of unfurling this narrative, there was a time when all the horses were being loaded into the gates, and Mongolian Groom balked. And you spent a moment or two on that. To what extent, you know, this is a little bit kind of intangible, but when he balked like that, to what extent do you think he knew he shouldn't race, or he knew he shouldn't get in?
Well, as you say, it's pretty speculative. It's mm-hmm. pretty impossible to know. I mean, Mongolian Groom had a catastrophic breakdown in that race.
Yeah.
And when you, I mean, there are other horses that are also not in a hurry to get in the gate.
Yeah.
But you could see in the broadcast, you know, horses backing around, and then, you know, the jockey and especially the gate personnel like pushing the horses in, and so often, you know, you project and you say, oh, that horse doesn't want to run, and then that horse may bolt out and win the race. You know, it's really hard to know what's in a horse's mind. And of course, after Mongolian Groom died, was euthanized, people went back to, you know, all the tapes of his training, runs, you know, his workouts just before. Oh, look, that leg didn't look right. Why didn't they catch that? And other problems he'd had over time, and how this should have been predicted, and he should have been scratched and not been in that race. I wouldn't say any of that stuff was really conclusive. I'm not an expert. I couldn't tell from his gait that there was anything wrong.
Sure.
And whether, I mean, how sore he was and whether he wanted to run it. It's, I kind of dramatized, you know, almost try to get the horse's point of view in that opening scene.
Yeah.
Partly to show the difficulty of understanding the horse's point of view. Like, there's a, you know, like the press is touting a rivalry between this horse and this horse because they jostled each other and won one, and then he got disqualified in an earlier race. You know, this one's out for revenge. Well, the two horses have no idea who got disqualified or anything else.
Yeah.
And there's a question about if they even know, like, who crossed the finish line first. You know, it's, do horses really want to win that race, or is it pure projection? You know, all that whipping down the stretch you usually see, that looks like part of the equation, but we don't really know.
Yeah.
You sometimes see a funny thing where if a horse, like, bucks off his jockey straight out of the gate, and so he's running without a jockey. This doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And then he runs with the pack. Of course, he's lighter, he can go faster, and it's funny. I mean, he just, okay, he seems to want to race. He's running with the others, and sometimes he's out in front, and other times he drops back, and he's not, you know, doesn't have a jockey telling him what to do. But that's just like case study. Oh, they do want to run. Look at this guy. He's running hard.
Yeah.
But then he might see the finish line and pull up. He doesn't, you know where it is, or he doesn't really care about winning.
Yeah.
So it's very tricky. I mean, you can watch young horses, yearlings, say, in a field and watch them, you know, bolting around. And they really seem to be racing, like who can get to the, you know, far end of the pasture first. But there's lots of projection in that. And racehorses need a lot of training. And need to take the training and you know, learn how to race. So I try to dramatize how we don't really know what they're thinking more than anything else. And then you have all these people jumping up to say what they're thinking. They don't want to race. Look at that. It's obvious. Or they do want to race. Look at it. It's obvious. It's,
yeah. Whatever you're bringing to the...
I'm agnostic about it because I just don't know what a horse is thinking.
Right. Well, we have just about reached the end of the time, but that does remind me one last thing is that I always thought it was kind of a little bit too glib when people would say, hey, horses, they love to run. But as you point out in the piece, well, at least when it comes to thoroughbreds, that's not untrue. It's the question of, like, how to keep them running and how to keep them in a race running where we get in a little bit trickier problem with the whip and some other stuff. But it's
I think you're right. The distance is kind of critical. I mean, a race might be, you know, short, 5 furlongs or something, or it might be long, like Belmont, be a mile and a half. And toward the end, most horses are obviously tired, and that's where this whipping comes in. And so it's a question of, do they really want to keep running that hard at that point?
Right.
That's where, I mean, in the opening, you know, a couple furlongs of a race, the horses seem to want to be running.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, they're really lame or they don't want to run. But most of them, you know, are out there bolting along, and this is kind of what they do. But it's that last part, to have them running hard in the stretch when they're tired. Seem like a lot of human intervention.
For sure. All right, well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with William Finnegan from The New Yorker. Again, his new piece available online is called Can Horse Racing Survive? And thank you so much for spending this time with us. William, again, a great piece that covers a lot of ground, and there's all kinds of shading and colors and issues and people and personalities, some of which we got into, but we couldn't get into all of them. So we urge people to check out the story if they have any interest at all in horse racing. So thanks again for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye. In a moment, we'll talk with Amber Lee of Ybor City Vegan Deli. Their breakfast sandwiches, Philly cheesesteaks, Cubans, and other fare have been winning fans and customers at this location at the other locations previously opened by this enterprise. We'll discuss this with Amber in a moment here on Talking Animals on WM. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with Jim Gaffigan and an excerpt of his lengthy piece called Horses. This portion edited, I'm calling Horse Racing, hooks directly to our conversation with William Finnegan. Let's hear it now in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
We are a country that loves to bet on horses. Every spring we track the three races of the Triple Crown, and every spring I always have the same thought. We're still doing this? Is Woodrow Wilson president? But people love the Triple Crown. The Kentucky Derby, where people bet on horses while they're dressed like characters from Gone with the Wind. It's like prom for gamblers. Do you like my hat? I'm living in my sister's garage. Because I have a debilitating gambling addiction. Shall we have another mint julep? They always announce the winner of each race on the news. You can always tell the horse was named by a guy on his eighth wife. The horse is always named like Viagra's Revenge. Alimony be damned. They show a picture of the winning horse on the news. They could show us a picture of any horse. We wouldn't know the difference. I don't know what we're supposed to do with that horse image. It's not like we're going to run into that horse in a bar. Excuse me, did you win the Kentucky Derby?
I did. I won the Kentucky Derby.
Now I'm in a bar enjoying a Hefeweizen. There is the classic photo of the winning horse, right? They're always wearing that huge horseshoe wreath of flowers they stole from someone's gravesite. Standing next to the winning horse is the owner of the horse, who did not train the horse, did not ride the horse, and based on body language, has never really met the horse. There the owner stands, looking like they've never paid taxes. Sitting on top of the winning horse is the jockey, who's dressed like he just came from a local pride parade. They always interview the jockey expecting some insight. They're like, how'd you win? The jockey's like, I whipped the horse and it ran.
Indeed. That's Jim Gaffigan with a piece I'm calling Horse Racing from a larger piece called Horses, taken from his album Quality Time. Let's speak with Amber Lee right now on Talking Animals. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Sorry, running a little bit behind. I ran a little long with my conversation with William Finnegan. But let's jump right in. When did the Ybor City Vegan Deli open?
So we had our soft opening actually on April 1st, which was April Fool's.
Okay. Well, that seems like a good time to hold a soft opening. And it seems like it's off to a great start. I mean, I keep hearing and seeing all kinds of cool things in social media, and obviously people really have been taken to it.
Yes.
And as I mentioned a couple times on the show so far, it's part of an enterprise operating at vegan delis in this area. So let's quickly hit a bit of history. So the first location, I guess, was in Dunedin?
Yes, Dunedin was the first location, and it actually opened up right when our country shut down.
Okay. Well, that's unfortunate timing, but it, I imagine it's rallied pretty well, given how things are going for the Ybor one.
Yes.
And then Brandon, I believe, was after that?
Right. Started with Dunedin last year, and then Brandon January of this year, and now Ybor, and as of Friday, Sarasota.
Wow. I didn't realize Sarasota was that imminent. That's great. So things are really taking off. So walk us through a few menu items that, especially if, like, some faves that have emerged.
Okay. So the Cuban sandwich is a big favorite at all locations. Especially Ybor, because of the history.
Sure.
We have a barbecue crack wrap, which has a barbecued pork, of course, everything vegan, with a whole container of macaroni and cheese wrapped up in a wrap to go.
Wow.
As well as a whack wrap, which is an impossible burger with whack sauce, as well as the macaroni and cheese in a wrap. We have our breakfast sandwiches, the McBluffins, are very popular, and we serve breakfast all day long.
That's great.
We do pizzas. We do vegan wings, your classic burgers, and all of the seitan products we make in-house.
That's great. So So just sort of in just whatever you can do in, like, you know, 20 seconds or so, what do you think? I mean, this, I've called this, and maybe it's a bit hyperbole, but whatever, this kind of a vegan deli craze. I mean, what does this suggest to you? Because it just seems like things have kind of, everywhere you guys have opened, it's kind of just taken off.
Right. The vegan movement is definitely growing. People are realizing that whether it be for the animals, the planet, their health, whatever it may be, vegan food is the way to go. Everyone's trying it. Everyone who comes in loves it. It's here to stay. It's growing.
Wow.
We are grateful to see that.
All right. So you can search for Ybor City Vegan Deli on social media and find out more and about the other locations as well. And I'm sorry we have to go now, Amber, but thank you so much for joining us.